from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, geography plays a key role in income mobility. That's according to a new study which examined millions of earning records. It's much easier for a child to rise out of poverty in cities like Boston or Seattle than it is in Atlanta or Columbus. We'll discuss the findings and what role tax policies play in improving income mobility. Forum is up ahead. Join us right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A new study researched by economists from Harvard and the University of California, Berkeley, concludes that geography, or location, to a large degree affects economic destiny. The study, which the New York Times called the most detailed portrait yet of economic mobility in the United States, breaks down geographic regions and reveals that a child born into poverty is more apt to move up the economic ladder in metropolitan areas where poor families were more dispersed among mixed-income neighborhoods and in areas with more two-parent households, better schools, and greater civic engagement. Black populations have lower mobility, but if you live in Atlanta, for example, children are as apt to have lower mobility there, whether they are black or white. And a child in Seattle has a much better chance of escaping poverty than a child in Atlanta. With income inequality overall on the rise for the past few decades, we want to focus in this forum hour on this study and what it means for ongoing economic inequality and the understanding of it. Joining us in the studio is Enrico Moretti, who is professor of economics at UC Berkeley, author of The New Geography of Jobs, a book we discussed with him a while back. And good to have you back.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Also say good morning to Nathaniel Hendren, who is joining us this morning from Harvard. He's an assistant professor of economics at Harvard, one of the co-authors of this study, along with Raj Chetty, Pat Klein, and Emmanuel Saez. And he joins us again from Harvard, and we welcome you to the program. Welcome.
Great to be here, Michael.
Good to have you. And let me begin, Professor Hendren, with you, if I may. And I just want to mention, first of all, for listeners' sake, that for a global perspective, there have been previous studies that have indicated that a smaller percentage of people escape childhood poverty in the United States than in other so-called well-off countries like Canada, France, Germany, Australia, or Japan. This study is pretty consistent with those findings on a global scale, isn't it?
Sure, that's right. As you mentioned, there's a lot of previous research suggesting that the United States has lower rates of economic mobility as compared to other rich countries, as in Europe. But what we've been trying to highlight with this study is that it's maybe not the complete picture when you just think of the United States as a whole. And so what we're really looking at is how do rates of mobility vary within the United States?
Well, they do vary in the Northeast, the Upper Midwest, the West Coast, particularly places like New York, Minneapolis, and San Francisco. You have a better chance of reaching a higher income bracket than you do, particularly in places like the Southeast or the Midwest.
No, that's absolutely right. So as you were saying in the introduction, if you're born to a parent earning less than $25,000 a year and you live in Charlotte, you've got about a 4.5% chance of earning more than $100,000 today. Whereas if you were born in San Francisco, that same chance is 11%, so more than double the odds of reaching into the top income brackets in the United States.
And it's worse in the South than it is in any other region.
That's the general pattern, yeah. But I think it's also important to highlight that a lot of the variation in mobility rates occurs even within states. So about half the variation is across states and half the variation is within states. So even, you know, within the South, there's tremendous variation.
But highest mobility rates, just to single out cities, because we're being heard now on Sirius satellite throughout the country, Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Seattle, Salt Lake City actually are on a level with Denmark and Norway versus other cities.
Yeah, that's right. As you go back, you know, Denmark and Norway are known as being some of the most mobile places in the world when people have looked at rates of economic mobility on a global scale. And that's true. You know, some of these cities like the ones you mentioned, you know, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Boston, these places do have mobility rates comparable to those places in Europe. However, in contrast, some of the areas that you were mentioning in the South, like Charlotte, Memphis, Atlanta, they have mobility rates that really are in some ways off the charts from a global perspective.
A lot of this also is tied in your study with such things as, well, your colleague and our friend Bob Putnam writes about social capital and family structure. Those certainly affect mobility as well.
So we did explore a bunch of different correlations with mobility, as you were mentioning in the intro. Our initial kind of focus on the project was to explore roles of tax policy, like the earned income tax credit. And we did find some evidence of some correlations along the lines of tax policy. But as you were mentioning, some of the stronger correlations we were finding were with things like measures of social capital. So I think that on the data sets that we've been releasing, been putting together on the web, we do find, for example, those familiar with the bowling alone study, the fraction of bowling alleys per capita is positively correlated with upward mobility. Now, of course, you know, that's a correlation. Who knows how to make of that? But that is the type of thing that is kind of interesting, and I think sparking some intrigue to really try to get to the questions of what is causing this differential mobility across areas.
Well, segregation hinders mobility too. I mean, this has often been pretty much assumed, but the study bears it out.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, in some sense, the correlations that we look at are definitely things that have been proposed in previous literature. And as you say, what we hope is that the data is helping to shed a better or paint a better picture, or at least an accurate picture of what mobility looks like, so we can really get to the heart of the kind of questions that you're asking.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Nathaniel Hendren, and he is an assistant professor of economics at Harvard, co-author of a new study called The Economic Impacts of Tax Expenditures, Evidence from Spatial Variation Across the United States. You talk about 740 commuting zones in this study. So transportation and access to transportation is also a key.
Sure. So, you know, the commuting zones are sort of just ways of representing geography, and those are kind of aggregations of counties. So you can think of kind of the San Francisco area or the Salt Lake City area or the Boston area. So here in Boston, the Boston commuting zone includes everywhere out to Cape Cod. And the idea here is to construct areas that are broadly construed as places where people live and work. Now, get to your second question, which is sort of how do the segregation within a geography relate to mobility. It's absolutely true that the kind of geographic allocation of wealth, so people that are if the poorer population is sort of segregated from the rest of the population, we are finding negative correlations with mobility, as you were suggesting, as has been pointed out as a potential correlate to find by previous literature, and something that's definitely being borne out by the data.
And how significant are tax expenditures and tax credits for the poor, I mean, in terms of moving up?
Mm-hmm. So we find some moderate correlations with tax expenditures. So things like local property taxes seem to be positively correlated with upward mobility, but they're sort of much less strongly correlated than the other factors that you were mentioning, like families, measures of family structure, social capital, and income segregation, income inequality, and the quality of the K-12 education system are also finding stronger correlations than what we've been able to find with tax policy variables.
And let me bring Enrico Moretti into this discussion. Important study overall, is it not, Professor Moretti?
Very, very significant. This is by far the best study that we have today on economic mobility in the U.S. It uses the most detailed available data and is performed by some of the best researchers in the era. So it's a quantum leap forward in our understanding of economic mobility.
Although there are still many areas like that are dark to us that we don't know, yes?
In some sense, yes. There is a lot that we learn from this study, and there's a lot that we learn that we don't know from this study.
I want to talk to some extent about that, but let me bring you to California here. We have high rates of mobility compared to many other regions in the United States, but the vast state that California is, there are vast differences.
Yeah, yeah, there are two striking findings on California from this study. First of all, California seems to be a state with high economic mobility overall when compared to other states. And this is great news. But even within California, there are pretty significant differences between cities like San Francisco and San Jose on one side and rural areas like Fresno and Eureka on the other side. San Francisco and San Jose have the second and third highest mobility rate among large cities in the U.S. Sacramento is also in good shape. On the other hand, Fresno and Eureka are at fairly low mobility.
Los Angeles kind of in the middle?
And Los Angeles and San Diego are in the middle. But overall, the difference between San Francisco at the top and Eureka at the bottom is not as large as the difference that you see across metro areas in the U.S. in general.
What might explain California's higher mobility? I mean, in general, because as I said, it's a huge state.
Well, one important determinant of mobility that the study uncovers is race and segregation. And California historically has low percentage of African American and lower degree of segregation than other parts of the country, especially the South.
And we also have Silicon Valley, I presume, which makes for more mobility, just like Seattle has Microsoft and those kinds of phenomena.
Certainly, economic growth seems to be one of the factors that affects mobility. I would say, going back to what we were talking about earlier, what's striking about this study is that for decades, economists have suspected that higher taxes and more tax progressivity, more subsidy to low-income family were expected to help low-income children to move up the income ladder. And overall, my reading of the study is that the correlation between these factors and mobility is not very high. That is much lower than the correlation that you see between family structure or community characteristics and mobility. In some sense, the study points to the important role of family and community in fostering mobility more than local policy.
And religion as well. Yeah.
Religiosity is one of the key factors. The most important one is single parenthood. That's the single most important, the single highest correlation between one factor and social mobility.
Harder for single parents for the usual kinds of reasons? Or did anything come out in the study, Nathaniel Hendren, that points to perhaps reasons that might be more invisible or more hidden?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I mean, as Enrico points out, the one of the strongest correlations that we were able to find with upward mobility is the fraction of single parents in an area. However, one really interesting corollary to that is that this is also true when you look at the mobility of kids born to married parents. And so it seems like it's not just the impact itself of having a single parent on mobility, but it's definitely something more about the place or the characteristics of the place as opposed to the characteristic of the individual family. There really is something to the community here.
There are a majority of differences, though, again, Enrico Murdi, that are unexplained. Where should research go from this, as you point out, significant and very important study?
Well, this study, it's such an improvement on what we knew before that I think we should celebrate its achievements. At the same time, a lot of the differences across American communities in mobility rates remain unexplained. In fact, the majority of it is unexplained. And so I see this study as a first important step into shedding light on what are the determinants of mobility rates in the U.S., but it's certainly not the last step. I would say that the study clearly points to the role that families and communities have in fostering economic mobility, and therefore the role that culture in economic and values might play more than the role that local government have in fostering community. I mean, certainly local governments do play a role, but for example, the results on schooling are a little bit underwhelming. Schools seems to play a role, but for example, local expenditure on schools are not a very important correlate of economic mobility. Dropout rates are. So it's a mix picture that you get, and it sort of shed light on some preconceived notion that economists had for decades on what we should do to improve mobility.
And certainly college education has to play an integral role here, too. I just saw some statistics. Jason DeParle, who writes for the New York Times and has for years, 60% of non-college educated births take place, 60% of births of children to unmarried or unwed mothers take place of those who are not college educated, whereas only 10% of those are college educated. This is pretty significant. I'm just wondering, though, where we might go on the policy front. Nathaniel Hendren, any ideas?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's the, as Enrico points out, that's something that, we're not able to really address with this round of the study. This is really a first step to just really understanding the kinds of differences we have across areas in mobility. And I think the important next step is to really understand the types of policies that can improve mobility. And, I think it's hard to really think about the kinds of policies that can, if it is culture, as Enrico was saying, then maybe it's a little bit, we should all be a little bit more pessimistic on being able to change things. But if it's more about improving the quality of schools and if it's improving improving various other types of public goods, then it is a little bit more of a rosy picture for trying to figure out, what policies are helping kids grow out of poverty.
Well, I wonder how, for example, we could change size and dispersion of the middle class, short of social engineering.
Well, I mean, that is a...
That's a big factor.
Yeah, it is a big factor. I mean, as you say, you know, we find both the size of the middle class in a local area and also the geographic segregation of the poor from the middle class is highly correlated with mobility. And, you know, obviously it would make a big dent on those types of entrenchments would be difficult. But I think what I think is hopefully going to be the path forward over the next few years, while people hopefully diving into this data and can help us all figure out what types of policies could work. I think we want to keep in mind that just because certain things may be currently correlated with low mobility rates, that doesn't mean that there aren't policies that might help improve it.
I'm going to open the phone lines now and invite those of you listening to join us. You may indeed have questions or comments, and some of those comments may be engendered by your own personal experience. You may want to weigh in here and simply join the conversation and talk about what you see as barriers to economic mobility or what you see as perhaps things that have served you or those you know most readily when it comes to moving up the economic scale. The ladder of success is certainly elusive in some parts of the United States, and that's what we're talking about here, and easier in other parts. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your phone call, so feel free to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. Geography, again, plays a key role in income mobility. That's according to a new study which examined millions of earning records. And it's a lot easier for a child to rise out of poverty in cities like Boston or Seattle or San Francisco than in Atlanta or Columbus or Memphis. And we're talking about those findings and also talking about the role that tax policies play in improving income mobility. Nathaniel Hendren with us by phone, one of the authors of the study, is an assistant professor of economics at Harvard. And Enrico Moretti here in studio, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, who is the author of The New Geography of Jobs. And we'll go to your calls and emails in just a moment. Enrico Moretti, how related is this to economic growth overall, or is it?
The finding on economic growth points to some correlation between economic growth and mobility. And this is probably one of the reasons why cities like San Francisco and San Jose are doing better than areas like Fresno and Eureka. San Francisco and San Jose have been growing for the past 30 years with some ups and downs, but overall the trend is upward, while these other areas like Eureka and Fresno are much more stagnant. And, you know, it makes sense. If there is economic growth around you and you are motivated and you work
so this
hard.
Is logical, really, that economic growth would have an impact. But how much of an impact?
It's not one of the strongest determinants, but it's not one of the weakest. So it's in the middle.
And we have a lot of determinants here that we've been talking about, but let's find out what our listeners have to say and have them weigh in. We begin with a caller named Suresh from San Jose. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, has research gone into the size of the family and when parents have kids, and is there any correlation to that? I would think size of the family would have a correlation to economic mobility. Thank you.
Okay, good question. Nathaniel Hendren, family size.
Sure. Great question. So it is true that larger families tend to have slightly lower mobility rates. However, the geographic patterns that we've been talking about remain true when you control for, say, family size. So it's definitely something that's important for mobility, but it's not something that's really going to explain the geographic patterns that people have been talking about.
What would you say to someone who, and by the way, the link to your study is now on our website, kqed.org/forum. Somebody said, well, here I am in Memphis or Indianapolis, Atlanta, whatever, and I'm concerned about my kid's future. I'm just going to up and move to Seattle or San Francisco.
It's a great question. And actually, Raj Chetty, one of my co-authors, and I are working on some follow-on work to try to address precisely that. I mean, I think the question is, you know, how much of these differences that we're seeing can you actually pick up by, you know, packing your bags and moving? And I think that some preliminary evidence suggests you might be able to get some of this. I think we want to be too cautious on speculating on those results too much. But I think that it is safe to say that there's some real differences that at least some of which can be picked up by actually moving across places.
And we'll move to some more of your calls. We go next to Chris. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning. The last Labour government in Britain took a major interest in social and economic mobility and actually did a lot of studies and actually set up a whole department that was trying to increase economic mobility in England, and I don't know what happened with it. I didn't follow up on it. But I'm just wondering if you're familiar with that body of work, and are there corollaries between what they found in England and what you're finding here in the United States?
I think Professor Enrico Moretti has something to add here. Yeah.
Well, for any progressive government, economic mobility should be one of the most important goals. In my view,
They found out in Egypt under Morsi, I guess.
For example, in my view, what's important in a society is not necessarily the degree of economic inequality at any moment in time, but it's the probability that someone who is born in the low part of the income distribution can make it in the middle or the up part or the upper part. In some sense, it's not necessarily the inequality that we see in every given day, but is the possibility that those who are at the bottom can make it to the top if they work hard. And in some sense, that should be the key goal for any government that tries to label itself.
Do you know how successful they were in the UK, though?
There were a number of studies, and a number of policies were put in place. But as the study suggests, it's not very simple to reshape income inequality and income mobility in the long run. Only time can tell whether the previous Labour government was successful, but it's a tall order.
But you know, Professor Hendren, I'm looking at some of these dramatic conclusions about 30-year-olds. One out of three who stay where they are, if they're from affluent or semi-affluent backgrounds, wind up making an annual income, I'm talking about the children now, transgenerational, of $100,000 from the top 1%, while only one out of 25 in that bottom half percent of income distribution can claim an income of $100,000. That's pretty stark.
That is pretty stark, and I think that's the economic reality of the United States as a whole. And that's something, you know, honestly, I think that type of statistics have been out there. I think what's surprising is how much that characteristic of the numbers you just described varies across places. And just to give you an example, you know, if somebody is born to parents earning, you know, less than $25,000 a year, and if you were born, say, from Dubuque, Iowa, you have an equal chance of being anywhere along the income distribution. So Dubuque, Iowa is my favorite example of one of the places that has some of the sort of what we would consider pure economic opportunity. Now, you go to other places like Memphis, where these probabilities are less than 3% if you're in the bottom 20th percentile to rising above and making more than $100,000 and rising into the top 20%. And so it's just enormous differences in precisely those statistics. And so that's what we think is interesting, and that's what we hope is going to lead to discussion to try to understand what those differences are, with the hopes of really trying to aim policies towards helping improve this mobility.
We have a listener, Professor Hendren, who wants to understand what you mean by social capital.
Sure, that's a great question. This is really nothing that we're inventing. We're trying to borrow a long literature in sociology and other fields that have talked about the role of social connections, social norms, and the kind of the interactions between people in fostering mobility. And so our measures of social capital are being borrowed from measures talked about in, say, Bowling Alone by Bob Putnam, where I think I was mentioning the fraction of bowling alleys in an area is positively related to mobility. But we also look at there's also measures that sociologists have constructed that are kind of clever. So things like the fraction of people that return their census forms, or the fraction of people that vote. So voting rates are also measures of social capital. So that's really what we're taking a look at there.
We're coming up on a break. When we return, we'll hear more from you, our listeners. And again, you can join us on our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And the phone number to call is 866-733-6786. Talking about a new study done by Harvard and UC Berkeley economist Nathaniel Hendren, one of the co-authors with us, and Enrico Moretti, author of The New Geography of Jobs. Both economists, both professors. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and it turns out that geography plays a key role in income mobility. That's according to a new study which examined millions of earnings records, location, location, location. It's a lot easier for a child to rise out of poverty in cities like Boston or Seattle than it is in Atlanta or Columbus, and we're talking about the findings and also the role of tax policies in improving income mobility. Enrico Moretti here with us in studio is professor of economics at UC Berkeley and author of The New Geography of Jobs, and Nathaniel Hendren, one of the co-authors of the study, The Economic Impacts of Tax Expenditures, Evidence from Spatial Variation Across the United States, which is on our website. The link to it, that is an assistant professor of economics at Harvard. Getting a lot of responses from listeners, some comments from our Facebook page. Katie writes, in the Bay Area, we have many advantages. However, my parents were able to afford to buy a house while being employed as skilled, not necessarily professional workers. Now, my boyfriend and I are both professionals, and things are different now. If the American dream includes buying a house, we are not able to, even with good jobs. Similarly, my grandparents were not educated and were a single-income family that afforded a second home, even. I'm fourth-generation Californian. I'm not sure what this all means for upward mobility, but I'm interested in listening. Another listener, Zach, says, growing up in a small Central Valley city, I've learned firsthand that while I was able to leave the area, it follows me wherever I go. Many of the friends I met in college from L.A. or the Bay Area have parents with connections to people of power and have had a much easier time finding their way in the world. James writes, who would know if I'm doing better than my parents? No one talked about money back in those days. And here's a listener who writes, and Enrico Moretti, you might want to give your thoughts on this. Your income measure does not include non-salary benefits, which have become a larger and larger share, thus affecting children more than parents. This would affect your results only if benefits were growing larger in certain areas that correlated with your tax expenditure data.
And that's a great question. This guy should be teaching economics. The researchers have used the best available measure of income, which is reported income in your tax returns. But the listener is clearly right. There is a larger and larger fraction of your income that comes in the form of healthcare and other fringe benefits. I don't think that if you included that type of income, results would change dramatically. But
you agree, Nathaniel Hendren?
Yeah, I would agree. I actually, that's a fantastic comment. It's like we're giving an economic seminar here. That's, but I would say that there's a lot of different measures that people have used of income, and a lot of the spatial patterns that we're showing are robust to a lot of different measures. So, for example, whether or not you include capital income or just wage income, the patterns are quite similar. Even if you include household income versus individual income, again, the patterns are similar. And I think what's important is to think of, we're asking how does these patterns vary between. The income level of your parent is and the income level of the kids. And as long as you're thinking of the same measures along those dimensions, the types of adjustments that we're talking about here don't seem to matter much for the spatial variation.
Well, we are getting some really good questions by listeners. I want to go back to our phones in a moment. But a listener writes, when did income mobility become equated with upward mobility? And is there a study of places where downward mobility is more likely, whether or not correlated with this one? Nathaniel Hendren?
That's a great question. So there's a bunch of ways of thinking about mobility, and in the paper we talk about two different ways. One is sort of a notion of absolute mobility, which is to what extent somebody who's born to a poorer family, what is the economic outcomes for that type of a child. The other kind of a mobility, which is also talked about, is a notion of relative mobility, which is what's the difference in outcomes between rich and poor. And these are related. You could have more upward mobility with or without more or less relative mobility. But the flip side of the coin is areas with more relative mobility might be worse for people that are born to rich families, whereas a notion of absolute mobility does not have that.
But the old axiom still holds up, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Well, so what we find is when you look across the United States, the spatial patterns for relative mobility are quite highly correlated with the spatial patterns for upward mobility for poor people. So when we talk about the income differences, this is, I think, a key result that we found, the difference between the rich and the poor, areas where there's greater differences between rich kids and poor kids, are also areas where the poor have a harder time coming out of poverty. And I think that's what that's saying is that most of the variation across areas is really about the poor rising up rather than the rich falling down.
Enrico Moretti, another listener, writes, very interesting. This study states that high upward mobility areas tended to have higher fractions of religious individuals and fewer children raised by single parents. However, when I look at the map, I see the Bay Area, an area I assume to have low religiosity with high economic mobility, and the South, an area with high religiosity with lower economic mobility. Is this determinant simply overpowered by others?
Yeah, that's also a great question. The Bay Area clearly has low degree of religiosity, but also has many other factors that tend to improve social mobility. So, yes, religiosity in this case is overpowered by other factors, race, segregation, economic growth, and general economic circumstances that make places like San Francisco a good place if you are trying to move up.
And we'll move to some more of your calls. Victoria, join us. Hi.
Hi. So my name is Victoria, and I'm coming from Stanford, and I actually did my honor thesis on Black mobility in Southern California, looking at adolescents who moved from inner city metropolitan Los Angeles areas to predominantly white middle-class suburbs in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And one of the things, and that's because that's my story as well, and one of the things that I found out in the study was that many of us actually experienced downward mobility. And so our families came to these suburban areas in hopes of giving us a better life. So we had houses and we had parks and there were libraries. But our parents were there on subprime loans. Our parents were there in apartment buildings. And so, yes, it seemed as if we did have mobility, financial mobility, with the backdrop and our communities being better than the ones that we come from. However, we still didn't have that same capital, financial capital nor social capital, that would have really given us what it was that we needed to actually go above our parents. And so many people look at many of the kids who grew up in this era, like, what did you guys do wrong? You had every opportunity given to you guys, and you guys didn't make much of it. But we really need to think about, did they truly have the same opportunities as their suburban counterparts? And did they have the same opportunities as those who are in urban cities, considering those who are in urban areas have various nonprofits and various government programs that are going into helping those in those areas get ahead or at least be sufficient, while in the suburbs we don't have those same social networks or those same social safety networks.
Victoria, I think we get the pith of your question, and it's an important one. Let me go to Nathaniel Hendren, if I may.
Sure. So I think there are a lot of really important points raised in that comment, and I think she's absolutely right to highlight the role of things like social capital and other characteristics of these local areas. And it's certainly not clear that what's good for say the current people that live in an area is good for people that come into that area. We go back to sort of some of the stuff that Bob Putnam was talking about with the role of social capital, social capital is important for sort of helping connections and family ties, and people talk about that often as a good thing. But he was very careful to point out that social capital is not always a good thing, right? It also can be very exclusionary. It can be, kind of an insider and outsider world. And I think what we're finding is that, on average in areas that have measures of higher social capital, they seem to be doing better for the people who grew up there. But it's certainly not clear that what's good for one is good for all.
Victoria, we thank you for your call. I want to get more of your calls on. We'll go next to Bill. Bill, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I wondered if you'd been able to see any correlation between social mobility and higher versus lower rates of union labor.
Enrico Moretti?
That's not one of the variables that the authors have looked at.
It's not in this study, but have you found anything from your own research?
I'm not aware of any research on this specific question. My prior would be that it wouldn't matter all that much, in the sense that the finding that you find these days in most of the studies on union labor is that unions don't have they become so weak they don't have a very, very an overwhelming power in reshaping the labor market of an area. So I would not expect that to be an important rule.
Let me thank the caller and go to another caller. Peter, that's you. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, it's Peter Warfield, and I wondered, I read the New York Times article, which was quite extensive yesterday, and was curious that there seemed to be a complete lack of mention of what seems to me important, and that is what's the availability of jobs or wealth generally in an area if you're living in hardscrabble, middle-of-no-place where people are just barely getting by farming or something. There may not be the accessibility. It's not necessarily the fact that you're at these coordinates on the map, but rather that there aren't jobs and wealth generally around you. There's another question I've got since it's come up in the conversation, and that is the question of mobility, what might be called mobility versus happiness. I think there are people that purposely may wish to stay at a certain level, or actually get downwardly mobile, even if they've had really, say, high-powered jobs and they didn't like it, but are happier being economically less well-off.
Now, Peter, that may be a subject for a whole other day, but job availability, I would think, plays an integral role. Enrico Moretti, yes?
Yeah, I think if you look at the differences across California communities, job availability does come out as a potentially important factor. Again, as we mentioned earlier, the communities that have the highest mobility are San Francisco and San Jose. Clearly communities where job growth and job availability has been fairly strong. On the other hand, Fresno and Eureka are the communities with the lowest mobility within California. I don't think job availability is the only factor, but it certainly will play a factor. If you are a 20-year-old who is trying to move from, say, a low-income group to get a better life, I think you're probably better off being in a place like where we live in the Bay Area than in a place where there are no jobs. I think it makes a lot of sense.
And let me thank you, Peter, for the call. Here's a listener who writes, the wealthier are drawn to wealthier places, and I think the main determinant of how wealthy a place will be is how wealthy it's been. We say that much is expected of those to whom much has been given, but in truth, they usually seem to be pretty good at getting even more without giving back all that much. Kurt Vonnegut's Elliot Rosewater's parable of the money river seems appropriate. Another listener writes, the educational policy to limit the percentage of low-income children per school resulted in all children performing at grade level and better. The clear evidence is that when one's peers care about education and economic mobility, you do too. Every school was good with parental participation and enriching resources and qualified teachers, and this was achieved without busing in North Carolina and elsewhere. Are the researchers aware of these programs? They demonstrate the results of their study. Nathaniel Hundred?
Sure, sure. I actually, you know, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back one comment before that, and then we'll touch on the role of peers. The comment about the wealthy places remaining wealthy, and I think this was something that we came into it with kind of the same intuition. Well, maybe places that are wealthy are good for mobility, or places that have kind of a high level of income are good for mobility. And one of the, I think, the striking things that we found is that that's not actually the case. If you know, just to be clear, what our notion of mobility here, we're imagining somebody who's born to a parent that earns, say, let's say $30,000 a year, and we're asking on average, how do those kids do? It turns out that how well kids are doing across areas is not correlated with the average income levels of those areas. And I think maybe this is because, you know, you're thinking of holding that parent's income fixed. And I think that's actually kind of surprising. It says that it's not really about rich places versus poor places. What really seems to matter more is about the distribution of that income or the geographic allocation of poor people relative to the middle class and the upper class. And so it really does seem to be a very fundamentally different thing than just wealthy places remaining richer. Although that was our initial intuition, we think that's been pretty soundly overturned by what the correlations are in the data.
I want to go to more calls, but let me go to some emails first. Holly writes, I am a very fortunate person. Honors from Berkeley, master's from Harvard, worked in the Clinton White House, native English speaker, fluent French and okay in Spanish, but I live in my native San Francisco. I'm a single mother by choice of an adopted child and take care of my elderly parents and much of their affairs. If anybody should be doing well economically, it should be someone with the advantages that I have. But the housing, childcare, schooling, and healthcare costs here are so incredibly expensive that someone like me, who should be doing extremely well, cannot if there are other family members to attend to, even relatively healthy ones. Can your guests address how the need for flexible professional-level work plays into this? Topics you covered on the show a few weeks ago. Enrico Moretti.
Well, great question again. Today you seem to have a very, very knowledgeable set of listeners. And
every day we have knowledgeable listeners.
Today even more.
Spoiled that way, yes.
I mean, she's raising a crucial point. You know, a place like the Bay Area today is undergoing a tremendous economic change.
But also one of the highest cost of livings anywhere in the country. Yeah.
That's true, but yeah. The two things are highly correlated. We're having a high cost of living because we have the strongest labor market in the U.S. The San Francisco County has the second strongest job growth for the past 12 months among all the U.S. counties. So in some sense, the high cost of living and the problems that the listener brings up are the flip side of a very good problem, which is a very strong labor market. Now, you can have a very strong labor market and less and smaller increase in cost of living. This is probably for a different show, but there are many things that the city of San Francisco could do to keep down cost of living, and I think
Well, they do have rent control.
I think the most important thing that the city of San Francisco could do to keep down increasing cost of living is to allow more more housing construction, especially in the right areas, more density and more accompanied by transit and provision of important public goods. I think that would go a long way in keeping down cost of living. Look at what Seattle did. Seattle as a labor market is as strong, in fact, it's even stronger than the San Francisco labor market. But it has policies that allow much more development of market-rate housing. And it's not surprising that Seattle has an increasing cost of living that is only a fraction of what San
Francisco. Did a program yesterday on Plan Bay Area, which, of course, part of it includes expanding the stock of housing, and people may want to go to our archives and listen to that. But Lee asks, Can someone comment on why California has relatively high mobility at the same time that it spends relatively little per student on public education?
I think one of the striking finding of the study, I must say, is that the results for schooling are a little bit more mixed than I was expecting. I was expecting schooling to be the key determinant of mobility. And my view is the view that most economists have, which is schooling this gives everybody the opportunity to those who are born in poor circumstances and those who are born in more advantaged circumstances, it gives them the opportunity to grow economically. I got to say, my reading of the study is that schooling doesn't come out as one of the most important determinants. For example, expenditure on local schools don't seem to be very highly correlated with mobility.
On the other hand, I'm looking at a tweet here that says, and maybe get a comment from you on this, Nathaniel Hendren, many of the geographic areas with high upward mobility are also areas with access to higher education. Coincidence?
That's actually was not our interpretation of the results. I think we found very minimal correlation with, say, the number of higher education institutions in the local area or tuition rates in the area. And those variables are posted on the website for people to take a look at themselves. Now, that's not to say that higher education doesn't matter for mobility. I think that would be crazy. I think everybody has a sense that, you know, going to college is one of the fundamental ways people rise into the upper income distribution. But what it does say is that it may not be the reason that we're seeing the differences in mobility across the geographies.
But you did find a fairly strong correlation to public schools K to 12, didn't you?
That's right. We saw stronger correlations here with things like test scores and dropout rates, as Enrico was mentioning earlier.
And we'll bring more callers aboard here, and we go to our next caller, Solmik. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Solmik calling from Menlo Park. And I wanted to emphasize Professor Enrico's powerful comment, which might get lost in all of the other findings, which is the role of values. And if I heard him right, he said that values seem to be more powerful and effective in producing income mobility than policies of governments, local governments. And in my limited experience, I know the correlation studies are good as far as they go, but they only go so far in giving us real insights on causative factors. So I'm wondering if the researchers here are planning to go further and incorporate qualitative methods to study values or culture to see what role they play and go beyond things that can be measured to get us some deeper insights.
Nathaniel Hendren, how much did that really come up in this study, if at all?
Sure. So, measures of values like the measures of social capital we were talking about before,
yeah,
or the measures of family structure we were talking about before, like the fraction of single parents in an area, these can be interpreted as sort of measures of quote-unquote values. I think what we wanted to do with this study is sort of take the first step and sort of provide some of these correlations for people to take a look at, but also release the data for other people and other researchers to really get their hands on it and explore the hypotheses that they have. I think there's so many hypotheses here for why there is such dramatic variation across places that I think we thought it was important to put this data out there so that people can actually explore those themselves. And so hopefully we will get to some of those to explore some of those factors. And indeed, we hope to do that ourselves as well.
And I thank the caller. A listener named Judy writes, I moved from Wichita, Kansas to San Francisco and felt an immediate upswell of optimism. I attributed that to weather and geographic factors. Farmers' success could depend on whether crops would be beaten to death by hailstorms, how much rain is received, etc., factors an individual cannot control, whereas in the Bay Area, the mild climate resulted historically in multiple access to food and shelter, although the big earthquake has not yet come. I'm sorry to bring that more note in. But another listener writes, what is the impact of immigration on a study like this, keeping in mind that California has the highest foreign-born popular of any state, both illegal and legal? A foreigner who has a high status in his native country comes to the United States and immediately starts working at the lowest rung on the economic ladder. Think Soviet doctor working as a cab driver. Continuing with this case study, as the foreign profession acquires his U.S. certifications and supplemental education, he rises rapidly on the economic ladder. How prevalent is this particular situation in California, and does the study measure this? Well, first, is the study measuring it, Nathaniel Hendren?
So we did look at the correlation between upward mobility in an area and the fraction of people that were foreign-born. There's two things to note here. One, that correlation wasn't incredibly strong in our data. But the other thing to note here is that our data is a sample of U.S. citizens. And so we're not actually taking into account upward mobility of people who are not U.S. citizens. And so that could be an important thing to look at into the future, kind of the integration of people who are not currently U.S. citizens into the citizenry, so to speak. And that's something that I think would be really interesting for future work.
And Rick, Almighty.
There's a number of interesting studies on upward mobility of immigrants, and what they point out is enormous differences across country of origin. If you, for example, if you compare the level of education, which is a good indicator of your economic opportunities, in among immigrants in the first generation to the level of education of their children, so second generation immigrants, you see that Asian immigrants, they have level of education in the second generation that is incredibly higher than the level of education of the first generation. By contrast, the level of education for immigrants from Central or Latin America tend to be not all that different from the level of education of immigrants of their parents. By the way, Italian immigrants are in the middle.
Where you bring up the level, though, I think, don't you? Let me bring some more callers here.
The question is what my son will do.
Dushan is our next caller. Good morning. You're on Forum. Welcome.
Good morning. I had a question about the nature of the data that was used, in particular when it came from, because we're kind of talking about present-day conditions in these various areas. But it seems to me if you want to correlate with social mobility, you have to look over at social and economic conditions over a couple of generations in these areas. So I was wondering how that was accounted for.
Yeah, Professor Hendren.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So our data looks at people who are currently around 30 years old today. So these are people born in age 30 when we're measuring the incomes. And so these are really the people who were growing up in these areas in the 1980s and early 90s. And so there is a question as to whether, how much has changed since then. And so when we talk about measures of social capital or some of these other measures of, say, the fraction of single parents, we're measuring those back in 1990, not today. Now, you can also look at measures of, say, economic growth between 1990 and 2010. And that's sort of when we talked about the importance of economic growth. That's the measures we're looking at to try to understand the role of economic growth, and we do find correlations there. But I think the answer to the question is we're looking at people who are around 30 years old today, and then there's an interesting question as to how stable this is over time, and I think that's an important question for future researchers.
And again, I think it's important to emphasize you did actually examine millions of earnings records, as we've said before.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Let me thank the caller and go right to another caller, and that's you, Tim. Hi.
Hi. So my question for the authors of the study is how geographic mobility is factored into the definition of social mobility of a place. If I'm born and raised in Detroit and I move to San Francisco when I'm 20 and I do well, is that social mobility credited to Detroit or San Francisco or neither?
Simple answer is Detroit. We look at where people live when they grow up, and to be very precise on that, we pick age 16.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, another listener, Ben, asks, he says, I'm curious about negative mobility. As an upper middle class person, I've always felt more secure in taking risks than some of my more working class friends. Enrico Moretti?
Well, negative mobility is the flip side of upper mobility, especially when you measure it relatively. So one of the important measure of mobility of the study was relative mobility. And of course, when you have people moving up, you also have people moving down. The other measure of mobility that the study looks at, it's absolute mobility, and that doesn't imply this zero sum game. And as Nathaniel was pointing out earlier, the results seem to be consistent across these two measures. So,
another listener from San Jose, Mike, writes: "For every person who moves up relative to the average, one must move down. Clearly, mobility is not an end in itself. Economic mobility is important when understanding affluence levels, since in a static snapshot, some who are low-income earners will later be high-income earners. But mobility is not a fundamental goal. The goal is some sort of lifetime average with weighting towards those times when people need money. Please explain the true significance of mobility."
Well, imagine two societies. They have the same inequality at any moment in time. But in one society, everybody has the job that their father had and the same income level. In another society, the job that you have and the income level that you have, it's completely uncorrelated with what your father or your parents had. I would call the second society a much fairer society, because it's a society, although it has the same inequality at any moment in time, it's a society that gives everybody a shot at having a good life.
On that note, Professor Hendren, maybe you could say something in conclusion about what you feel is most positive for people in this study.
Well, I think the positive takeaway from this is that there are some places that are tremendous at helping people get out of poverty. And I think what we hope is that the work that will go on over the next few years will really uncover why that is and what can be done to make all places a place where people can have opportunities from very poor backgrounds.
And again, you can go to our website. You can continue this discussion on our website or our Facebook page, but also go to our website and find the link to the study, The Economic Impacts of Tax Expenditures, Evidence from Spatial Variation Across the United States. Nathaniel Hendren, thank you for being with us, one of the co-authors of the study and assistant professor of economics at Harvard. And thank you, Enrico Moretti. His book, again, is The New Geography of Jobs. He's professor of economics at UC Berkeley. When we return, we'll spend an hour with Anna Deavere Smith. I hope you will join us for that. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.